I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 162 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is Stephen McDonald of the band Red Cross, which is having a moment right now. Red Cross is one of those bands who for decades has been overdue for massive recognition of their super catchy, sometimes punky, sometimes bubblegum-inspired, good-humored, high-energy guitar rock. Now Red Cross has a new memoir, Now You're One of Us, co-written by brother bandmates Jeff and Stephen McDonald with Dan Epstein. The band also is the subject of a new documentary, Andrew Reich's Born Innocent, The Red Cross Story. The movie, in turn, inspired songs that became the justly acclaimed 2024 double album titled simply Red Cross. Stephen McDonald started playing bass with his older brother Jeff when he was just 11 years old in 1978. They were two kids growing up in the Beach Boys' hometown of Hawthorne, California, and opening for the punk band Black Flag. At the age of 13, Stephen was abducted for several months by his adult girlfriend. It's clear from the book, the documentary, and this conversation that this episode was traumatic for Stephen and his family. You don't need to show me. I don't need this shit. I'll take your word for it. Yet he bounced back to bring bright energy to Red Cross's live shows and albums. They include the breakthrough pop-punk mashup Neurotica from 1987, the slicker major label debut Third Eye from 1990, the sublimely crunchy Phase Shifter from 1993, and the power poppy Show World from 1997. Even after an extended layoff, Red Cross came back as strong as ever with 2012's Researching the Blues, followed by 2019's Beyond the Door and the self-titled double album. I and many others love this music, yet the band never quote-unquote took off. Red Cross and Nirvana shared the same manager and never even were on a bill together. As you'll hear, this sort of thing really bugged Stephen McDonald. Jeff McDonald, who appeared as a Caro Pop guest in September, for a long time was the band's primary singer-songwriter. But Stephen, who also wrote and sang, assumed a lot of the managerial duties as well. He took the lack of commercial success personally, and still does. In fact, one of Stephen's songs on the new album, Way Too Happy, was inspired by a dismissive quote about Red Cross attributed to Kurt Cobain in the documentary. Stephen has some choice words about the late Nirvana frontman. Stephen describes himself as an award-winning approval seeker, and he is candid about his relationship with Jeff and their band. Does Stephen still feel like Jeff's younger brother, or at some point did they become just brothers? How did they wind up splitting the songwriting 50-50 on the new double album? Who did more heavy lifting on the melodies versus the lyrics? How has Stephen balanced his Red Cross duties with his gigs playing bass with the Melvins, Off, and Beck's band? What mistakes does Stephen think were made in the naming and marketing of Red Cross? What was the basis of his and Jeff's fight over the color of the cover of the new album Red Cross? For what it's worth, it looks like the Beatles' White Album, but is red. There's a lot of great candy-colored conversation here. Please enjoy Stephen McDonald on Caro Pop. I feel happy. That's where I am today. How does it feel now playing shows compared to other years? Is there sort of like a culmination feeling of all this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, there's more songs to choose from. It's harder to pick a set list. Now, there's this sense of, I guess there is. I mean, it's hard for me because I'm always striving. I'm always trying to, like, show people what I can do. I don't know if that ever goes away. Maybe that's what one would expect at some point. Like, oh, you finally have nothing to prove and you can just relax. That doesn't seem to be in my makeup. So
right.
I'm still always like... It still have that same kind of feeling I had in 93 or in 89 or first show, whatever, of like, I hope I can show them what I can do tonight. You know? But there is a little bit more of like with the age of respect, I suppose. But that's something that everyone in their 50s should be feeling, you know. It just feels a little less, I don't have that same defensiveness that I had in my 20s, you know.
There you go. or your teens for that matter.
Yeah. I remember always walking into guitar stores and feeling like they're not going to let me pick up a guitar because I think that I'm just a kid and then they're not taking me seriously. And that feeling extends into all walks of creative life, I think. And, but maybe some of that defensiveness has subsided a bit.
Well, so you have this memoir in which you and your brother are co-narrators, basically going back and forth between you guys. You have this documentary, you have a double album, you know, the self-titled double album after all this time. So there is kind of like this gauntlet being laid down, like, here we are, people, get it.
Well, yeah. I mean, like you kind of said, a summarizing or something, and which implies an end of sorts. And I almost think it's like, yeah, it's a gauntlet of like, okay, we're starting now. Now we're like, okay, we've been preheating the oven. Now we're ready to bake.
This doesn't seem like a like farewell sort of thing. This isn't like, you know, the Cher, whatever, you know, 15th farewell tour. It sounds more like, hey, you know, here we are. It's time for people to put it all together already.
Sure. I mean, I definitely felt like the album was really inspired by the movie and in terms of like getting it done. Then part of it was also inspired by my Melvin schedule, because I knew that Buzz was doing a year of solo stuff in 24. So the practical matters, but for the most part, I mean, I feel like I'm also still always trying to stake my claim as a working musician and that Red Cross is a viable member of the touring circuit.
And sure.
For outsiders, people don't necessarily know that that's really hard to do. It's very hard to make your sort of fun project a viable one that's not just a vanity project, one that is like makes sense and that you can go and do it and make a living doing it. And in many ways, that's kind of what this year has been like for me. Just like, I've just been keeping my head down and just yes to everything, even though knowing that like deadlines for a book and a movie and an album are all going to hit us at the same time. And that, you know, I'm not sure if my cardiologist would have necessarily suggested such a feat. But for me, the goal is, you know, like, let's get a real agent. Let's do this for real, you know, kind of thing. Which is like boring behind the scenes stuff. But I mean, all that stuff is kind of coming into place, and what we do with it now, I'm not exactly sure, because I'm just about to dive into a year's worth of touring with the Melvins.
Oh, there you go. when you recorded, when you guys wrote the song Born Innocent, which is a throwback to like your first record, but it's like, it's, you know, like the culmination over the end credits of the movie and the last song on this album. Were you making the album when you wrote that song, or was it more like you wrote the song for the movie and then said, hey, let's do a record?
It's somewhere in between. I mean, Jeff and I had been writing independently and writing together in 22 and 23. And then writing together a lot in 23 in the earlier part. And Andrew, I just didn't quite know where we were going. I knew we were going to make a record in 23. I didn't know. I had a couple of different scenarios brewing of how we could do it. Yes, Andrew threw that assignment at us, the filmmaker Andrew Reich threw that assignment at us, I don't know, sometime in the spring of 23, and said, would you do like an origin story song for the closing credit of the film? And, you know, I thought of like Creek Alley by the Mamas and the Papa. Right. So I threw together a recording session in the summer of 23. Dale Crover, who plays drums with us mostly, was out of commission he had a back surgery. And my old buddy Josh Klinghoffer, who I played in Beck's band in 2004, we've known each other for 20 years now. It just had been revealed to me that he had taken all of his incredible collection of recording gear and his beautiful guitars, and he had a friend that had helped him assemble it into a functioning studio. And I asked him if he would consider, because he's a multi-instrumentalist, he was a kick-ass drummer too, and if he would help us do this song quickly. And then that just went really well. And then when that went really well, then I realized, oh, we have to do the album in this environment, which we weren't planning to record until November of 23. So I had all that time to kind of chase Josh down and try to get him to commit because he's a very busy guy. And, but so, yeah, it was more like, and then originally Andrew wanted that song to just be exclusive for his movie. It wasn't going to be on our album. I guess he wanted to make a soundtrack album, but I guess it would have been of a bunch of re-released Red Cross. I don't know. But at any rate, the double album concept came late in the making of the new album. And once we realized we had 17 songs basically done, I knew that if I could talk Andrew into letting us use Born Innocent, then we would have the same amount of songs that the Rolling Stones put on XL and Main Street.
There you go.
Double album, that's good enough for me. If it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me.
Well, and it's promoting the record, and it promotes the movie because you got the title. So, you know, there you go.
And also there's several songs on the record, I think, that were somewhat inspired by seeing an early cut of the doc. And in many ways, I feel like it's sort of a companion piece for the movie. It's, you know, I know Andrew's goal is to get the movie into a lot of people's consciousness that know nothing about us, have never heard a single note. And it seems like he's made a compelling enough story that you don't necessarily have to be a fan already to like be able to watch the whole film, you know? And so I was really feeling like, well, I want to make sure that we have something new out there in time for whenever this thing happens that Andrew's trying to make happen, so that, you know, ideally if someone watches the movie, knows nothing about our music, and then wants to seek us out, I wanted to make a record that could maybe, you know, be a really great entrance into our music. Like now you know a bit about the dynamic of these brothers, and maybe you relate to some of their crazy stories. But here's what they can do musically. And I know some of that comes across the movie, but, you know, we're an underground band, so there's not tons of like great sounding live footage, and there's not, we don't have a, you know, like a old gray whistle test to keep referring to throughout the film or whatever. So there's only little snippets of things that are necessarily all that palatable to the ear. But at any rate, so yeah, you know,
the great YouTube deep dives are all of your talk show late night stuff around Phase Shifter, where you're playing like Jimmy's Fantasy and I think what Visionary, but you're playing on like Leno and Conan and you're
an English TV show too called The Word. Yeah, that's how we do Visionary on The Word.
Right, those are great. Those are really fun.
Put me back. That was a fun little run. Yeah, and it's great that the stuff's getting, you know, revisited now.
Right, and then you find the stuff of you guys as little kids in a, you know, on a little platform stage and, you know, somewhere. So at what point were you when the doc's being made? You're coming up with the album, the self-titled Red album. When were you working with Dan Epstein on the book?
That's all going
on the whole time.
Yeah, well, the Dan thing, like, that was mostly, I was in 23. It extended into 24. That's the deadlines for the book really hit around the same time as the deadlines for the album, because there was a lot. The one thing that I got saddled with a lot was trying to help the publishers get photographers to sign off on the images. And that was a new realm for me, and I wrote lots of letters and things like that. But yeah, mostly the interviews were mostly conducted over the course of, I don't know how many months, 6 months or so, 8 months of Dan doing interviews with Jeff and I separately. And originally I thought the book would be in 25 when I would have a moment to breathe, but then, and it was part of the publishers. They were like, well, you guys are going to be active then, so we're going to put a rush on this. And
so you hoped that they would sort of be not all hit at once. You hoped it would spread out a little bit more. Like you'd watch the movie and then you'd read the book the next year.
Yeah. Or something. I just meant for my own sake of sanity,
right.
But I'm glad of it all happening now. I mean, I'm looking forward to these shows this weekend, but I'm also looking forward to getting them done. So, because I take on a lot of the heavy lifting and like organizing stuff, and it can be, you know, anxiety producing.
So it's like, well, it sounds like when you're making Beyond the Door, you were also like doing like five different things at once, and you're producing it and performing it.
And I never wanted to do that again. Yeah. I was in three bands, and I was also recording everything, and that was particularly trying. I was recording everything on like most of it was like project studio gear. So, you know, what I was able to accomplish was limited, but I was always pushing myself to become a better engineer. So I let my ego sort of rest into this like technical, and I was more like just sort of being, assisting other writers. And that was with Off. I'd recorded what ended up being the newest Off record. I recorded it twice in 2019 and they'd never been released. I recorded 25 songs with Mario Rubalcaba playing drums. I recorded 25 songs with Dale Crover playing drums while I was also recording Beyond the Door, while I was touring the world with the Melvins. I was trying to keep everybody happy at the same time. And it sounds like I'm bellyaching. I'm not.
No. It just sounds like you're really freaking busy.
Well, I was grateful for the work, but I was also feeling like I was kind of failing at some things, and it was crazy making. And by the time I was done with Beyond the Door, I was a bit of a shell.
Well, and then I saw you guys play in Chicago at Metro, and it was Red Cross opening for the Melvins. Oh. So who's on stage twice? You.
Yeah. Yeah, I played double. I did double duties. Yeah, right. I forgot about that. Yeah, and you know, whatever. Once again, I'm grateful for all of it, but there's always that desire to feel like you've got a handle on everything, and sometimes it's hard to just kind of constantly pivoting, going with it, and rolling with it, and problem solving.
Right.
While I'm spent. So that was one of the things with this new album. I was like, okay, I don't want to record it and I don't want to worry about the technical. I actually want to, for once in a long time, be the artist and then help my brother as the artist. And I was really grateful about that because Josh Klinghoffer was so supportive and she helped me do stuff that no one's ever helped me do with my stuff. So that was great. And it was smart, you know, like at the end of 2019, I felt like it was just hard for me to think about things for a while. And then ultimately after lockdown and a while to think about how things had gone, I thought maybe next time I'm going to try something different. And it's always hard to acknowledge maybe something where you didn't think you did your best and what you can do differently. And it was really hard for me to kind of acknowledge that because I'd rather just kind of imagine everything's a success and don't worry about it, keep moving. But no, this time I tried something different and because I thought maybe it could be better this way. And I am really pleased with how, and then we've also just been very lucky. I mean, I know we're kind of talking more about the documentary today, and that's another example of working with someone else and trusting in them and not being, obviously I'm not a documentarian filmmaker, so I couldn't have taken on all that heavy lifting, but I am one of these people that if I see a gap in something, I try to help fill it. And so right. I could see myself like taking on the producer's role or get the key light out for Jeff's close up or something, you know? But anyway, I didn't have to do that. And Andrew is very capable. And even though he says he didn't know what he was doing half the time, he's done a great job. And I'm very grateful to be working with all these really great people, Dan and Andrew, Dan with the book, Andrew with the movie, and then Josh with the record.
No, it's been a fun Red Cross immersion because it all goes together really well. And on the album, the new album, just to go back to that, you're certainly, I mean, there's obviously more songs on it than any other record, but there's certainly more songs of you writing and singing. So it seems like it's a conscious thing that you've sort of stepped up on the singer-songwriter part of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've always been a collaborator, and you know, and also just the dynamic with my brother. He's my older brother, and you know, I mean, it's hard with bands because you know, in order for things to function, a hierarchy kind of naturally takes place and just kind of comes out naturally in some environments, and or sometimes it's very explicit and specific. But and I think that you know, with my brother and I, the collaboration is a lot of times it's been more of like, you know, I've added a riff here or there, or maybe I started something, but mostly it would be about supporting my brother's artistic vision. And in recent time, like being on tour with the Melvins for a long time, I just started bringing a guitar with me on the road. And I just found myself find like the desire to kind of complete some songs, or rather than waiting to get together with Jeff to finish a song, I just found myself finishing songs and just sending them to Jeff. And I don't know that Jeff was necessarily like all that fired up to make another record, but I just kept sending him songs. And after a while, I think he was sort of like, well, I better show up to Steve's house at some point, or he's going to write this whole record. You know, I mean, lyrics are, you know, not easy, but I've been doing our social media for years too, and like just putting yourself out there, even if it's just something stupid like a post, like realizing at some point, like, oh, I can actually put some words together, and I shouldn't be so like that's someone else's domain. And so yeah, I mean, that's kind of what's happened. And you know, but for the most part, I would say with the writing, the way it kind of, if you break it down track for track on this record, I would say that Jeff and I pretty much were, it was pretty 50-50 in a way that's never been before. And where I would say I quarterbacked more of like the music, which would include the melodies as well. And he quarterbacked more of the lyrics. And then, yeah, whatever. And then there were just some songs where I had finished on my own, and ultimately it was like, okay, you should just sing that one. And maybe, I think Jeff likes his role as like lead singer.
Right.
I think he was a little, that was one thing that kind of, I never really realized. And it kind of revealed itself while making the record. And the fact that we did expand it into a double record, that's why I ended up singing lead on three songs. And then we did a couple of duets together. And that's why he kind of loosened up on that, staking that claim, you know. That was a surprise to me, because I've always been like, okay, well, you're the lead singer. Then what am I? Oh, I'm the bass player. It's like, I didn't really realize we had that, you know. But
producers sometimes. I mean, you've been his brother for your whole life, obviously. And you've also worked together for most of your life. Does the older brother, younger brother dynamic ever just become we're brothers, or is it always older brother, younger brother?
It depends on who you ask, I'm sure.
I'm asking you, like, what do you think?
Well, I think for me, yes, I'm always going to want his approval. I don't know if that's ever going to go away. And, but I mean, I want everyone's approval. I'm an award-winning approval seeker, you know, to be totally honest. And, but, you know, but to get his approval is, you know, probably some kind of prize, a grand prize. But, you know, I think as time goes on, I kind of realize, oh, but, you know, there's a downside to that. And there can be a reactiveness that happens if that's, you know, underlying the software of our relationship. And I've learned more and more how to go like, oh, you know, no, I need to find that within. And I need to kind of figure out how to, you know, not be looking. And you know, and he would probably think that he has nothing to do with that dynamic, or I'd be like, oh, you're putting that on me. But I would maybe question that, because certain things have been made very comfortable for him over the years because of that dynamic, you know. And if suddenly you're shifting it because you're finding, oh, I'm actually more independent than I realized, then suddenly you realize, oh, well, he was actually a little bit more invested in the way that was than he might have realized. And it's always a negotiation, and it's always going to be a little bit of a you know, but as long as you're, I think for me, trying to be honest with myself as much as possible, and then, you know, It's always about good faith, you know, trying to have conversations in good faith and stay up to date. You know, I can't control what others do, but I have say over my own reactions, and that's kind of it. And so as long as I keep the focus on that, then, you know, hopefully the other person is doing a similar version of the same thing, but, you know, you never know. And, but also the other thing I've kind of come to terms with, and podcasts sometimes help. Like I was just listening to a Conan O'Brien interview with Eric Idle, and I loved it because Conan loves to talk about creative collaborations and how hard they are. And Eric Idle was sort of talking about how, like, when the Python started, even George Harrison, or maybe more of the Beatles, kind of felt like, oh, as the Beatles were winding down, that Python was kind of like the new band in town, the new creative collective of people that are having to navigate those waters, those challenges. And it's really kind of freeing for me to hear people that I think of in such high esteem and think of as like, oh, you know, to be able to relate so much to their trials and to hear them say that, like, you know, you would be in the depths of despair over, like, whether or not a chair was funny, and that everybody had very strong opinions about that chair's not funny, this chair is funny. And it's just absurd, you know, because that's like, that's the nature of creative collaboration, that it's subjective opinions negotiating.
Right.
And there's all these different things that come to play, and you add a sibling dynamic to it. And they were just going to say, like, you know, it's miserable. It's fucking horrible. And to hear them say that and go like, yeah, but the positive outweighing the negative, and that, or that what might feel miserable in one moment, then later on that day, or even the next minute, you're fucking busting a gut laughing so hard. And that, you know, I think just giving myself permission, because a lot of times, you know, it's easy to fall into this thing of like, well, if it's not fun, then I shouldn't be doing it, or dreading that I can't do this anymore moment, you know, or something like that, where people ask for divorce or you want to get a divorce, et cetera. I don't know. For me, it's freeing to go like, no one ever said it was going to be easy. And,
right. And
you know, and it's like, you think it's hard now, wait till you have some real success, things like that, you know? Right. So I just have to, you know, take a step back and hopefully breathe at the right time, and then just lean into gratitude and do the best I can, because that's all I can really do.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, and a touch of German hops and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. In the book especially, I get the feeling that you were kind of more, of the two of you, you were the one who was kind of more cognizant and concerned with sort of where you guys were as a career, and wanted to get the recognition and sort of the success, and, you know, maybe more than Jeff, who sort of wanted to have his kind of, you know, whimsical, quirky, you know, we're just going to do this because it's fun, and we're not going to do it because, you know, it might help us or help our career. Does that sound accurate?
Well, I mean, you know, that's what he says. You know, I mean, I often think people who claim to not play the game of life, like I am willing to admit I do, I sometimes think are maybe, I think it's a heroic ideal. And I think that's also playing to a certain audience to a certain extent. You know, sure, you might also get, you know, strokes of affirmation from the people that, that view you as a true maverick and outsider. And I could say that. I could create that picture for myself, but I feel like it would, at a certain level, would feel disingenuous. And I'm not to say to completely be dismissive of him about it. I also think that Jeff has not had to have the same practical concerns that I have had to have. And our lives have panned out a little differently in some ways. And So I think in some ways it's like, well, okay, yeah. So does that give you like some kind of creative higher ground because you don't have to worry about making a living necessarily, you know, and whatever. And that's not, and if he was sitting right here on the podcast, I wouldn't be as candid as I'm being right now, but you know, but the thing is, it's like, but it's true. I'm willing to admit that, like I said, I'm an award-winning approval seeker. And I guess that is a dangerous thing to say in public, not like to not be saying that in therapeutic circles, to be saying it in a public circle, because it might sound like you are some kind of, you know, yes guy or ass kisser, insincere somehow. And I think it's important for me to say, you know, I want approval, but I want them on my own terms. You know, I always want to show people what I can do.
It's no, I think it sounds more like you're being honest, but saying, yeah, we wanted to be successful. We wanted, you know, we wanted Neurotica to, you know, conquer the world. And we wanted to be, you know, as popular as Guns N' Roses or Nirvana.
I feel that there's a lot of people who won't admit to the wanting that. And I often just kind of think like, no, it's human nature for, you know, I just think for most of, I can't say for anybody else what their motives are, but I think there's a part of me that's skeptical of people who claim that, that they intended to fail or something to that effect, or that they don't measure things in these ways and they're on some higher plane, you know, or that it hurts, you know, that something turns out a certain way that you didn't expect. You know, I'm willing to admit all of that because I think that I can't see the upside of taking another stance, you know. I can't see enough of an upside of taking another stance. Or maybe I'm just foolishly oversharing. I don't know.
Were there points like back in, you know, when you guys were sort of becoming, you know, on the rise and more people were knowing about you, where, you know, there was sort of a sense of these other bands from, you know, the LA scene or whatever were succeeding, and you may be thinking, hey, let's make sure we're in the conversation with those bands and not in the conversation about, you know, the Partridge Family or, you know, whatever sort of pop culture thing. Cause it was such this, I mean, it's a really fun visual and, you know, I mean, all the different, you know, stuff that you brought in to, you know, Red Cross at that time is what made you guys Red Cross. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't have done it. But I'm also wondering if there was any sort of like push and pull between you two of like, hey, let's pull back on these things that some people are not going to get and lean into the stuff that they will get.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that we've discussed it. And like in the film, we talk about that 2Ds as a, you know, spelling.
Yeah, you guys keep coming back to the 2Ds.
Well, it's funny because on the new record, like I really was very much like I had this vision for the record cover that it would be the Red album, R-E-D-D, you know, and then that would just be an insider's thing. And that, because at one point Jeff did call me, he wanted the record to be blue. And I was just like, dude, what are you talking about? And it's so great that because we got into a fight and it didn't, and it lasted for a week. We didn't speak. And, he still hasn't told me I was right, but
he still want to call it Red Cross, but have it be blue.
He just didn't want the red cover. He thought that it was going to leave. This is his thinking. It looks too much like Bee Gees Odessa. Everybody's just going to say Bee Gees Odessa.
It's not fuzzy.
And I know. Well, because the thing was, well, our picture, if you actually hold the vinyl, you can see what it is. It's actually a towel. It's an embroidered towel.
Oh, okay.
Was sort of textural and fuzzy, but except we were doing it on a budget. And he thought that, and I was like, okay, well, Bee Gees Odessa is a cool record, but, you know, I'm thinking a bit broader than that. And whatever I was still thinking about two D's and a K also. And at any rate, and I'm also glad it didn't become Blue, because Jack White put out a Blue album this year as well. And, you know, whatever, that just was a luck thing. But, you know, I mean, I think that, but just this idea of, or when like we started around the Born Innocent era in the early 80s, and we started actively, you know, distancing ourselves with like outrageous clothes and stuff from the group that we'd come up with, the sort of what became Southern California hardcore. I mean, sure, you know, it's like, that stuff still comes up. It's like, we just played at Punk Rock Bowling, the big festival in Las Vegas every year. And we'd never been invited to play Punk Rock Bowling before. And that was started, it started by the Stern Brothers, who had a hardcore band in the early 80s called Youth Brigade. And we actively kind of like rebelled against that world. I mean, we might have played with Youth Brigade, but we were also probably wearing platform shoes and posing like Kiss and acting like, you know, getting a rise out of the crowd rather than like trying to get them to slam dance. And yeah, in some ways that worked to our benefit, because a few years later we were drawing 1,000 people in Los Angeles, and like people that were like, you know, Partridge Family obsessives, and it was really kind of working out for us. 30 years later, we don't get invited to Punk Rock Bowling, and that's this big industry for these people. And we did get invited to play, and it was funny because I saw we were just playing a club gig that they do around the festival, so we weren't even on the main stage, but I thought of it as a good warm-up date for the beginning of the year of Red Cross. It was back in June of 24 and or May. And but it was funny because at the nightclub where we were playing, the person who was putting up the names on the marquee, they didn't know. They just unwittingly wrote Red Cross, R-E-D-C-R-O-S-S. And I actually thought in a moment, like, do I tell them to change that or not? And I was thinking about like the crowd that would be around that day to be middle-aged punk rock guys. And I was thinking like, who's more likely to buy a ticket tonight? I mean, what if they had, if they saw on the marquee REDCROSS, the band that opened for Black Flag that you see in all the Black Flag flyers, would that more likely like get walk-up action tonight? Probably. But then I had to think, yeah, but it's, you know, do I own who we are now? And it just so happened the guy was still out there with the letters, and I just told him, hey, can you change that to D's and a K? And he did. And I thought at that moment, I go, okay, I did that for my own sense of identity, my own sense of who I am now. But there's a part of me, it feels like we're not going to sell out tonight. And
because of that,
sell out the venue, and it's true, we did well that night, but we weren't fully embraced by that environment, and those are decisions that we made years ago, and you know, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. I don't know. I mean, I think this way. Jeff doesn't think this way. He doesn't have to think this way. I also like do all the organizing for the band. Like I booked that show. I didn't book it. I mean, I worked with the booker and, you know, whatever, like I do a lot of behind the scenes stuff. So I solicit a lot of stuff. So I'm the one that fields the no's, and I'm very familiar with how hard it is to create opportunity for us sometimes. And, you know, so maybe I wear too many hats. I don't know. But so I think that I am at a stage in my life where I'm enough of a grown up to take on these concepts and still get on stage and have a good time.
So, but the two D's and a K thing is like this albatross you've been carrying around for all these years.
Well, for me, like I said, I fueled a lot of the incoming traffic for the band. So basically how that one, manifests for me is that anytime I'm doing business for Red Cross, if people don't spell it correctly, which they spell it correctly maybe 50% of the time, I always feel a little bit of like, yeah, I know we're not famous. I'm sorry. There's always a little bit of like, ah, we failed. And it's stupid and it's totally ridiculous, but it's always, it's very leveling. And it's very much like, And for my brother, it's more like, oh, you're not part of the club yet, you know, or something, whatever he tells himself, I don't know. But for me, it's just like poor marketing. It makes it confusing in the marketplace. And I mean, I've come to the place where I realize anytime anyone spells it REDCROSS, REDKROSS, REDDCROSS, like all the different inversions of it, they're still talking about someone that plays music under the name Red Cross. It's us. It's always us. But it's like, but I think that, you know, it's just hard because you find yourself, like, I know our old manager, like an inside joke about him was that it's always like, yeah, I got it, John, and two D's and a K. Like, he would have to chant it over and over and over to anybody he was doing business with. So, you know, Jeff is in a different position than me. He's in some sort of privileged, self-imposed place where he doesn't ever field that thing over and over. I do, you know, and it's a little bit, you know, annoying at times.
Huh. I mean, the book is called Now You're One of Us. And
exactly.
And the implication is, again, you're joining our club, you know?
It's also based on a Jeff McDonald lyric. It's from the song Neurotica.
Right.
And come on, lose your mind. Now you're one of us. It's like, long-haired friends of Jesus in a chartreuse microbus.
Right.
Come on, lose your mind. Now you're one of us. And yeah, you know what? It's tribalism. And that's what bands are. They are, it's a group. And it's, you know, I mean, it might seem like weird high school peer pressure BS too, but we've always been, you know, I think our idea is like, well, we're misfits. We're misfit toys, just like that Rankin Bass cartoon.
Right.
That Christmas thing. And we're the island of misfit toys. And you're a little bit broken too, or you're a little bit weird, or you have interesting inclinations. And come join us. Now you're one of us. And I think that's where we're coming from with that whole mentality.
When I was living in Boston after graduating college, I had a friend's four track, and I would make these cassettes. I would record songs that I wrote, and they were trying to be kind of like funky, psychedelic, poppy sort of things. And my working band name was Chartreuse Microbus, not having ever heard Neurotica, by the way. It was just totally like just a throwback to Convoy, because I just thought that was just the funniest phrase. And I thought that was a good band name, except for the fact that if nobody would ever be able to spell chartreuse correctly. But I feel like we're sort of bonded a little bit in this whole Chartreuse Microbus thing.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, yes, yeah, it's funny. Yeah, and no one, exactly, no one would be able to spell chartreuse, which would be frustrating, right?
And they wouldn't like the color. Like, if you had to like actually make your album covers chartreuse, people would be like, "Nah, that's not a good color. Can't you make it red, like that cool Red Cross record or something?"
Well, I don't know. Chartreuse is very green, right? Is that what?
Yeah, like kind of a yellow green.
It's like an acidic green, yeah.
Yeah, you just, you know, you picture your microbus that's chartreuse. Well, I mean, that'd be a great logo, like, though, so there you go.
Yeah, there you, like, you were just sitting there with your four-track, and you had your idea, but you even had, you went into that marketing place for a second, and you thought, I can't name myself that, because it's going to confuse the marketplace.
Yeah, but then I never formed my band and put my songs out into the world. So there you go. Yeah. They're like, there are too many of us who just do that, where you just sort of like write your stuff and then you're just like, well, you know, that was a fun one for me and my friends to hear.
Well, I mean, it's true, but I mean, I think that's also, I mean, sometimes it's a good lesson to just, you know, whatever, nothing's ever perfect. You just kind of have to just keep moving forward too. And you know, I don't know. Cause like, and once again, but the thing about like the Red Cross spelling, though, for us, it's like, I haven't always been against it. I just thought that at one point, I just remember saying to Jeff, like, well, it's a little bit confusing. And then he would always be like, no, it's like Red Fox. And
right.
He'd be like, oh, yeah, everyone's going to get that. But, like, you know, whatever. Like, I love that about Jeff. And I know right now I'm kind of debunking Jeff a little bit here and there. And maybe that's because I'm 70 shows deep in a tour. But look, I think that he has been ballsy. He has been willing to be like, who cares if they can spell it right or not? And he didn't say no. Like, you know, it's much easier to say no than it is to say yes to things. And things aren't ever perfect. And you kind of, sometimes you just have to like navigate it not being the way you would have chosen necessarily. And that's kind of what real life is anyways.
Right.
And more so than not. And, you know, but it's, it can be anxiety producing. Whatever, we're surviving it.
Well, you guys have been, you know, on the sort of tangent of like so many scenes, like, you know, coming out of punk, but then there was also like, you know, metal, and there was Paisley Underground, and there was power pop, and we're just straight ahead rock. Like, is there one of those categories that you would feel like you ultimately wound up in, or is it really like, no, we just make Red Cross music?
Well, I said something. Now I can translate on, you know, it's easy with Google or whatever, you know, you're online, and I was reading Spanish reviews or on social media what these Spanish people were saying about our shows. And there was somebody was saying some snarky things, and they were talking about, oh, too metal or this or that. And I wrote, Red Cross transcends genre, which got a laugh from my place. But, you know, I mean, it's hard for a band, you know, it's like, no one wants to wear a label, you know, we want to be free to like delve into all these things if we want. And, but, you know, I feel like the label part of it is like, it makes sense in the marketplace to explain to the, you know, what someone might be getting themselves involved in, you know? And I know what it's like. I mean, for me, I always want to know, where is someone from? My kid plays me a lot of music now in the car. And I'm always like, oh, this is interesting. What do you know about them? For some reason, I always want to know things like that. And some people want to know, you know, what genre it is. And, but I mean, I don't know. I think that, no, people think rock and roll is a corny genre, or it's an old, you know, dad rock. Dad rock is fine with me. I know that dad rock is now, you don't like that one. Well, I know when I go on.
It's almost redundant because rock is so weirdly marginalized right now. Like, I just sort of can't understand it. Like, the idea that something that sounds like the Beatles wouldn't be considered commercial, I just find like, what? Like, you play it for kids and they still love it, you know? Like, it's timeless. Like, there's music that's timeless, but the stuff that's popular now, it's somehow has marginalized the things that, you know, you and I grew up loving. So
sure, but I will have to admit that the dad rock playlists on Apple Music, I find I like most. So that maybe that's me just, you know, making peace with the industry, the gatekeeping tendencies that we have. But, you know, I don't know. I'm fine with any of them. I mean, metal has a stigma to it that I don't ever like. I always think like, well, not that kind of metal, this kind of metal. But whatever, it's fine, or hair metal or whatever. But, you know, I mean, we're a rock band. I mean,
you're a melodic rock band. You got hooks.
Yeah. Yeah. Melodic rock band. Melodic. I'm okay with that word. And, but also we're free to not be melodic at times too. And, you know, but, guitar band. When people, you know, ask you in random places, I see the group walk into a place and they're like, what kind of music do you play? What are you? And, I've kind of taken a cue from Buzz Osborne. He likes to just tell me, oh, it's just a bunch of screaming. It's loud.
I mean, given where rock is right now and also just where the music industry is, does that change your approach when you're making an album, or is like an album and that's what it's going to be, whether, you know, more people are going to buy it digitally or on red vinyl, which I got, or whatever?
No, I mean, I wouldn't even know how to survey the landscape for it to get any meaningful information that would help me. I think that we make the record the way the record that we want to try to make the best record we can make. And then I suppose, you know, practical matters come in after, you know, like for instance, Merge didn't want to, they thought it was a bad idea to do a double record. And so that's why we went with In the Red, and who were just like, that's the best idea to do a double record. And maybe on practical matters, maybe production costs are high. It's hard to make a profit. And not to say that we don't need to concern ourselves with that, but we just felt like, back to this I have something to prove thing, Jeff was still saying like, yeah, yes, we're finally going to have our Zen Arcade. Like, we're still competing with, Husker Du, who are like, one third dead, or Double Nickels on the Dime, another half dead.
Right.
But at any rate, I did think, though, in the big picture, it was probably good for our reputation to do something more substantial. And I thought it would probably, so I really liked that idea of us having a record, not only because I could write more songs on it, or I was feeling more confident creatively, but also I just like this idea of, I guess, being taken seriously.
Bigger swing of the bat.
What's that?
It's a bigger swing of the bat, because it's like, yeah, this is a double album. They're again, as I was saying at the beginning, you're like staking, like, all right, this is us, it's
right.
And when you put out in a regular album, people put out regular albums, but the double album always has like that, like, the Beatles White Album, which you guys are sort of riffing on. I mean, it's not as all over the place as that record, but it definitely feels like a statement when you come out with the big double record.
Yeah, I guess nowadays I would say it was a bit of a flex. And
a flex. Yes, that's, I'm sorry, I should have said that.
No, wait, the baseball metaphor worked too. I get it. And so, and then the goal with the flex or this bigger swing is that, not just, it's not just about, the audience reception. It's also about, just being viewed. Cause I mean, like, I think that there's a, like, you're asking like about fitting in with certain things. I think at this stage, like, I'm just kind of like, I just want to be taken seriously. I see people like Robert Pollard, who I know are brilliant songwriters, like, he's just like a faucet. It just comes out of him nonstop. And I could never be that, but I'm, I would be, it'd be disingenuous to not admit that I'm somewhat envious of how seriously he's been taken. And I think that, it's always our bid for that. Anytime you put out a record, you're like making a bid for to be able to be a legitimate part of the circuit, so to speak. And, and I love my day jobs and I'm grateful to have them. But I also, what it also brings up for me sometimes is how much like I haven't accomplished certain things, and that's one of them, and so, like being a legitimate part of the circuit, so like you have a real agent and you can like book tours 6 months in advance and promoters are going to know you're not going to lose money and whatever. It's a functioning working entity, and people don't, I don't think your average person considers like, oh, that's a hard thing to do. And that is, it's not just like, oh, the sad life of a touring musician. It must be so lonely. It's like, no, you're calling your own shots and you've created your own little world and you get to make money doing something that you love doing. And, I think most people could relate to that goal of making money, doing something they love doing. And it just so happens the one I've chosen has gone through so many different changes and the landscape has changed in so many different ways. And it's definitely about live music nowadays. And I think Red Cross is, I'm very proud of what we've done this year. And I'm very grateful for Dan and Andrew for, finding our stories worth toiling over and helping us to just establish ourselves even more, because it just never ends. You've always got to prove yourself. And, even like people that have succeeded beyond anybody's wildest dreams. I mean, I look at Madonna's face now and I'm like, it proves to me that she still feels like she has to prove herself. And it's like, and it's bizarre, but it's like, it seems to be part of human nature, not to say that I'm exactly like Madonna. I'm just saying, like, it doesn't seem to end.
I think that's true. I think almost everyone I've talked to, mostly musicians, some producers, some actors, but there's always that kind of that sense of, oh, you know, we're still trying to get to that spot, and you know, we hit some magic moments there, but then there were disappointments, and it's all, I don't know. I was talking to a friend of mine just about celebrity memoirs, and I was talking about like Charles Grodin's memoir, and I'm just like, that book is like 85% failure and 15%, hey, Heartbreak Kid, Heaven Can Wait, you know, Midnight Run, you know, and like, but the amount of work that has to get done to get to those high spots, you know, is tough. But you know, but that's sort of what, like, any successful career, you know, with some exceptions, is going to be made up more of like the struggling part of it than the payoff part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I've known some people, like, I live in Los Angeles, and I've known people, particularly in the world of writing, like television, and where it seems like, wow, you were just upwardly failing. How does that happen? like everything, nothing's, no one, they hadn't had a big, like, massive success, but they keep climbing some sort of ladder, and then
I need to do that in Chicago. I haven't figured that one out here. I think that might work better.
Like, how did you do that?
I haven't figured that out.
But it seems like most people, yes, it's true that it is just like no after no, or just like disappointment after disappointment, and so much of the game seems to be about persistence and just willingness to somehow not getting traumatized by those moments, and where you can just keep going and you can have your Charles. I mean, I can imagine his book probably really plays up on the disappointments, because that's kind of part of his aesthetic, right, too, like the, oh, well, kind of-ness of it all. But yeah, I mean, I relate to it, and I, you know, and you try to see how, you know, whatever, like, just pivot and let it fall off you. I forget what all the good expressions are for this, but and then when good things happen, it seems very important to, like, try to be present and acknowledge them, and not just wait for the, not just go straight into the, yeah, but then how would he follow this up? And you know, and the, because it's very hard to not get into that problem, because we're so conditioned to constantly be solving the problems. And at some point, it's going to be like, but there is no problem to solve. And then, well, how do you sit with that?
Yeah. Well, you know what? The beautiful part about music is that all those, you know, records you made exist. And, you know, you have all these people now who are listening to Big Star. And, you know, when I was trying to get into Big Star, you know, their records weren't in print. And, you know, all these people know Nick Drake now, which is kind of crazy. Because Red Cross has all this, like, fantastic music that's out there. And, if you know, and at some point, someone will put, you know, Annie's Gone in a movie, or, you know, Dumb Angel, or just something you don't even expect. And then it'll be like, oh, wait a minute, these guys are great. So that's...
anything can happen. It seems like the more willing we are to not live in the back of the cave, the better chance we have of these random things happening. It's true. But even if we just, like, powered it all down tomorrow, it's true. Anything could happen. And it's hard to say if there's a direct connection between our efforts and the outcome. But yeah, you know, and it's funny to talk about Nick Drake, because just this morning on my way to school, my kid was playing me some Nick Drake. And
the fact that your kid was playing you Nick Drake is...
oh, because it's yourself. Someone, that's actually someone I've never taken a deep dive into, but, and it was a song called A Place Beneath the Sun, or Places Beneath the Sun.
Things Beneath the Sun, I think.
I think. And, it's funny because, Allison Anders and Tiffany Anders, the filmmaker and the music supervisor, mother-daughter team, Allison made a movie called Things Beneath the Sun. That's what it
was. And,
Things Behind the Sun. Yeah. And I remember, and I was drawing a connection between the two, because I also remember Tiffany referencing Nick Drake. And I remember just, they made me think about them. And I was like, oh, that song title reminds me of that movie I was actually in, and whatever. So all these, like, synapses firing. But wow. Yeah, but yeah, and Alfie is getting into Nick Drake, and it's so fun to, like, that's such a fun window for me, entrance point, to have my 15-year-old be the expert. And you tell me, tell me what's good about this, you know?
So this album, you have the song Way Too Happy, which is based on like a crack that I guess that Kurt Cobain had made years ago, which is clearly stuck in your craw. But also like watching the, I'm going to sort of make this a combo question, you know, in the book and in the documentary, I mean, there are some pretty upsetting things, including this whole period where you're getting kidnapped and then Jeff's drug addiction, which, you know, is more in the book and in the movie, he clearly doesn't want to talk about it. And, you know, and in the movie you have, you know, like your parents kind of, you know, reacting emotionally to both of them. So like the idea, so it's like, it's not like just this kind of like, oh, these happy-go-lucky kids who never knew any hardship. It's more like, I don't know, like, did you need to go through that stuff to get to where you were artistically?
Oh, I don't know if I needed to go through them.
I wouldn't say you needed to get kidnapped, but I guess I'm thinking more in terms of like, you know, it's just such a traumatic thing. And I'm wondering how much that kind of carried on with you or whether that was something that you were able to.
Well I think that, you know, it's interesting. We often talk about it in relationship to the film that it's like the kind of crisis that, you know, maybe a storyteller would want to happen in the third act and it gets resolved. And then that, you know, the hero's journey is a little clearer and everybody cries at the same time and applauds at the same time. And that's not the way it happened in our life. And Andrew had to put it in the first act like it actually happened.
Right, because you were 13.
Yeah. And then next thing you know, we're like making an album inspired by a Linda Blair TV movie. And that's sort of us processing the trauma of that abduction episode in my life. And but, you know, I mean, it's like, I think that, no, I mean, these are just things that happened. And I've thought a lot about them. At the time, I think I just wanted them to go away. I wanted everything to be normal again and feel good. I felt horrible about the trauma it had caused my family as well. And as you can see in the film, it's still just underneath the surface and somewhat, you know, unresolved. And I did think doing the movie made me realize, oh, I probably have some work to do on that. And especially now that I'm a dad to a 12, 13, well, at the time and during lockdown, like I said, I was like the 40th anniversary of that time. Alfie, my son, was 12. So I was really like digging into it and thinking about it and wondering, you know, how it happened and how it's affected me and, you know, why it happened. What are the nature of the dysfunction of our family and what could, what can I do to understand it and what can I do to make sure I don't pass these things along, et cetera, et cetera. So those kinds of things came to play. You know, once again, I'm really grateful that Andrew has handled the subject respectfully and well and wasn't overly exploitative about it. I mean, I realize it's a hook for people. It's a different story than your average rock doc. But it's also not something that defines us.
Right.
It doesn't define who I am or who we are as a band. It's not the biggest or the greatest or the most. I mean, it's definitely unique, but it's not what defines me as a human being. And I think one of the ways it doesn't is, you know, doing the work, you know, figuring out how it happened, figuring out what are the dynamics at play and how can I not. Because I also was very embarrassed for years that I would be taken in by someone else's dysfunction and, you know, be manipulated in such a obvious way. And even though I was so young, I had told myself for years I was precocious and smarter than other people. And, you know, whatever, I'm human. But then, yeah, so you're asking about the Kurt Cobain connection too. You were sort of like, what?
The song, I sort of got into it by mentioning the song Way Too Happy. Like you guys are just somehow this happy-go-lucky group and they're
the interpretation of our performance. He's like, why are those guys so happy? That was his review after a show in 87, I guess. And and then hearing it in like 2023 and and being like, well, you know,
had you not heard that before?
What's that?
Did you only hear that in 2023 or did you hear
it? Yeah, when I saw the rough cut of the film.
Oh, okay.
I hadn't seen the interviews. I didn't know what, you know, Andrew showed me a rough cut late in his editing process. And that's the first time. And I don't remember Dale ever saying that to me, or maybe I let it go through one ear and out the other until I saw it actually being voiced for public consumption, that I kind of took in this idea of Kurt Cobain's, you know, hot take on the first time seeing Red Cross. And, you know, and just what it, that kind of triggered some old stuff because, you know, we had the same manager as Nirvana, and I had always sort of stomached losing the attention of our manager once Nirvana took over. And it came like hot off the heels of us having a disappointing go with our major label debut. And so it was like, first we were suffering the blow of our major label debut not going as the label wanted it to. And then bam, our manager is now managing Nirvana. And like, I hear good things. And the next thing you know, they're the biggest band in the world. And then it goes on. They turn out to be the most important band of my generation. And he was the most important songwriter of my generation, born only a few months away from me. And so it would be impossible for me not to have some sort of reaction to that information. And especially considering I had always thought during the time, and I don't want to sound like an entitled crazy person, it's actually real, like that it was like, okay, I can't get John on the phone anymore, but maybe we can open for Nirvana. That'd be awesome. And then we never got to open for Nirvana. And it was always a mystery to me. Why didn't we get to open for them? And I know they had all sorts of chaos in their world. I mean, you've got a reluctant, you know, lead singer who's in like constant crisis, and he's the one that's making everybody money. So, and everybody is like in the, like learning about navigating successful music industry for the first time. It was just a lot of chaos. And I don't think it was very happy, but here I was on the outside thinking like, can we open? Can we get the anointment? Can we, what do you think? What do you think? I mean, you know, we've been around for a while and we're cool too and blah, blah, blah. And then never be, then always kind of being like, no, or Courtney thought you were mean to her when she was fat is what we were told. And we're like, what?
Wasn't it like some prank call that you guys made that
but it was like you were just being funny
and then.
Yeah. And so it was sort of like, we were mean people. It was like, we were whatever. It was like, there was some kind of revenge going on or Kurt didn't like us or whatever, mysterious bullshit. And yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous that I would still have thought about that stuff 30 years later. I think I mostly put it to rest. I put it all to rest, but like seeing Dale say that made me feel a little bit like, fuck you, Kurt Cobain. I'd be like,
a lifetime has passed. You can say that now.
Like, yeah, you didn't. Maybe like, oh, you didn't like that we were like perpetuating good times. It's like, well, you know, I mean, like, where to rape me get you, you know, 6 feet under. I don't know. I gotta know what I'm saying now. Now I'm just bullshitting, but because I love Nirvana. I absolutely love Nirvana. And I think it's just, you know, I think that never getting, also, you know, a lot of bands that we were, like, for instance, it's funny how things work out. Like, I think I talk about it in the film or in the book. I say, like, Reading 92, the year that Kurt, you know, was pushed out in a wheelchair by Everett True, the big NME writer, and they were headlining, and it was the biggest, you know, there was big to-do. And they headlined the last day of the festival, and we were lucky to get on the festival, but we were on the festival as the first band on the first day.
Right. You're the beginning of Saturday. They were the end of Sunday.
Yeah, no, we were at the beginning of Friday.
Oh, Friday and Saturday.
People are still stuck in London traffic. You know, the only people that are going to see us are the people who stayed Thursday night in the mud and camped. And, you know, so, but we were, you know, it was like the day, the headliner that day was the Wonder Stuff or a cool pop band. But like on the Nirvana day, it was like Nirvana, L7, Melvins, Teenage Fan Club, who we had toured with, and they were the one English band on the bill. A bunch of the bands were all like bands that we knew and hung out with and had rehearsed in the same rehearsal place and felt like our peers. The headliner was, you know, managed by my manager. We were the first band he worked with. And I felt really much like, why the fuck are we not on that day? This sucks. And it's just funny because the band that played the opening slot, the one slot that we could have maybe been on that day, is the Melvins, who I've been in for the last 7 or 8 years.
There you go.
And of course, the Melvins were miffed. Oh, because Mudhoney were on the bill too, a band that had opened for Red Cross before or whatever. And the Melvins, I think, were miffed that they were opening. And they're still miffed about that, you know, that they weren't higher on the bill. So it's always something. It's ridiculous, you know.
And the guys in Nirvana probably were mad because something in their rider was off or something like that, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think they were a very happy camp. From what I understand, it was like that whole scenario was miserable. And, you know, and Kurt was miserable and unfortunate. He was caught in, I mean, the whole thing about, you know, success and failure and blah, blah, blah. It's like, I can only imagine what it's like to have that kind of pressure placed on your shoulders. And then on top of it, at such a young age and with not a lot of tools of how to deal with shit. So, you know, I mean, you know, like Jeff says in the documentary, oh, are you bitter? He uses that early on. It's some during some differences that we're having, I guess it's in the trailer. And instead of like, it's like a device to get me to shut up because it makes him uncomfortable that I am still expressing belly aching about, you know, certain things. But the reality is it's like, no, things have turned out the way they should have. You know, had what I wanted to happen then, maybe Jeff McDonald wouldn't be alive anymore. Maybe I wouldn't be. I know that everybody that got their dreams come, the supposed from the outside in, dreams come true from our graduating class, pretty much all of them are dead now. So the grunge era did not look out for their golden geese very well, I don't think, or something about the what was being encouraged from them was not a positive one. The sort of apathy of the Gen Xer and that being the defining mentality of like, you know, what's the point? Futility. It's not great grounding for anybody. And, you know, so I guess it's easy for me to once again be grateful that things work out.
Yeah. You look at like, you guys are looking at Stone Temple Pilots and they have that Big Bang Baby song that sounds like a Red Cross song, but you know, Scott Whelan's not around.
And he was a really sweet guy.
And he was a big fan of your, I mean, you guys toured with him, right? And he was about you.
He was very forthcoming about, you know, being admiring what we did. And he's a prime example. It's like to be put in that position and when you don't really have and there's just not a lot of help for those people. I don't know what the deal is, but sad. There's so many examples of it. So, you know, whatever. I try to get profound and then I realize Mick Jagger wrote this years ago, but you know, you can't always get what you want, but you try sometime, you find you get what you need. And I definitely can say a 27-year-old Mick or whoever, however old he was, he's enlightened. And I think it's one of the reasons why he is still out there doing what he's doing. And he is not of the same ilk as the rock stars of my generation. You know, different values, different mentality somehow that, you know,
Is there one moment that you look at like this was like your peak moment with Red Cross, whether it was on a stage or playing something in the studio or writing something or hearing playback? Like, can you pinpoint like this was like the happiest Red Cross moment?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I still can have those all the time. I mean, I just love a great show where everything is just landing. And it doesn't always happen, especially, you know, after talking to me for a while, you can see I'm a bit, I'm probably a tough customer on myself, but and others around me, unfortunately. But when it really lands, it's just so satisfying. And when everybody in the room feels connected, and it's hard to cultivate these things. And most nights you get somewhere, but there are some nights when you just really cross over and you get to this other place. And the times those happen, there's an afterglow that lasts for a long time. That's always possible, and I'm always looking forward to that. I mean, as far as there being like one accomplishment and feeling like this defines it all and I can die now and I can stop, I don't have that moment.
Yeah, but you don't look back on like, I was looking out at the crowd and the LA whatever, and I thought that was like my favorite moment or something like that. I mean, I don't know. I would have a hard time answering that question if I was asked it, but.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember there's been times. Yeah, once again, it's just like every once in a while, there will be like some kind of super connected moment. And it's usually revolving around stage. But usually it's like if I walk into a thing with a lot of expectation, it's just like it's a scary, dangerous thing. And usually if I'm looking out over a crowd, I'm also thinking like about 20 different things and about, you know, trying to, you know, don't choke up on the pick too much. Don't sing too hard. You're flat, sharp, you know, things like that. And it's I can't really hear. I hope that, you know, it's a lot of mechanical shit that is super boring for people to think about. And that's why I love it. It's such a privileged place to be road tested. And to be able to, once the muscle memory kicks in, like 10 shows in, and then you're just in this lucky place of like, I'm this much closer, so much closer now to just being free to just to whatever could come my way tonight. And you're not so trapped in that mechanical place that I just described.
Right.
But it's
you can get out of your own head.
Yeah, it's hard, you know, because there's a lot to tend to.
Well, and you've done it with so many different lineups, too. And it's sort of amazing that, you know, you have all these Red Cross albums and performances that sound like Red Cross. But I mean, you know, I've heard you with a lot of different drummers and different guitarists.
And
you're the bassist. I would think that would be especially tricky for you with the drummers, at least.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, but I've been playing with Dale now for the better part of a decade, and that's great. I love
two bands.
Yeah, and two bands. And I've got to play with a bunch of great drummers, you know. And it's also, but that's part of being in a band. It's also like managing all the different personalities. And I'm definitely more of the, you know, I'm the guy that takes on all the organizing. So I concern myself with making sure everyone's happy. And, you know, like I just read like some little clickbait thing. It was like, Kim Deal talks about keeping Josephine Wiggs happy, what it takes to keep her happy. And I was like, oh my God, is she really outlandish? Is it difficult? And I went to it and it was just clickbait. It was like, it was something in passing that was nothing. But, and I don't know if Kim Deal's the kind of person that does put a lot of time into worry about keeping people happy. I know I do. It's really hard for me if I think that someone is if their rent is overdue or something, and that we need to make sure that things are working out for them. It's a lot to take on, but whatever. It seems to be part of my journey, and I'm game to try to do it as gracefully as I can.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you talking with me. It's sure. I've loved your music for a long time, and seeing you on stage and hearing you on records and seeing you in videos and everything else. And so this is a real pleasure. And I'm a fan of the Z Malibu Kids too. So if you guys follow that up, I actually own the, what is it? Spanish pressed CD of that. So
of the album or the single?
The album. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Sound It Out. It's great. You know, that record only thanks for saying that. And I did recently listen to that record because someone was asking me about power pop in the early 2000s. And I was just trying to think, well, what were we doing? And then I stumbled onto that. And that record is available for streaming on Apple. That's it.
Is it now?
And nowhere else. And yeah, some of my favorite Jeff McDonald songs are on that record. And and Anna has great contributions. And I even finished a song on that record that is pretty fun. And yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And hopefully we'll get like a nice reissue sometime soon.
That'd be fun. Yeah, I know. And the line "Researching the Blues," I think, is in that Fiona Apple song that's supposedly not about Fiona Apple. So,
yeah.
Well, great talking to you.
Thank you.
That's it for episode 162 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Stephen McDonald for taking us deep inside the world of Red Cross and making us feel like we're one of them. Born Innocent, the Red Cross story, currently is showing across the country with screenings scheduled at the Gateway Film Center in Columbus, Ohio, January 3rd through 5th, the Harris Theater in Pittsburgh, January 4th, 5th, and 8th, and Alamo Draft Houses in Austin, Texas, and Denver on January 9th. Plus, the January 6th screening at the Beverly Theater in Las Vegas and the January 9th one at the Alamo Draft House in Los Angeles will feature live Q&As with Stephen and Jeff McDonald and director Andrew Reich. Go to redcrossfilm.com/watch to get tickets for these and other screenings. Also, be sure to pick up Now You're One of Us, the memoir narrated by the brothers with Dan Epstein. It's a great read. And of course, all of this should send you back to the music. Maybe start with a new self-titled double album and work backward. The stops at Researching the Blues, Face Shifter, and Neurotica, and then everywhere else. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who, like all of us, was born innocent. If you'd like to support Caropop, we'd be much appreciative. Please go to caropop.com and you can give $24 or whatever you'd like. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Twitter X at Caropopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Happy New Year, everybody. Thanks.